Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Face Connecticut, an in-depth look at today's issues.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Face Connecticut on WTIC News Talk 1080, WTIC FM, and WTIC.com. We are pleased to be joined this morning by Karen Jarmock, President and CEO of the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Good morning to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
It is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, so we thought it would be good to have you in and give us a status report on where things stand in Connecticut.
Well, domestic violence continues to be a serious public health issue in the state of Connecticut. We know that just within the Connecticut's 18 domestic violence organizations, there are approximately 40,000 individuals who seek help every single year. For a state our size, that's rather notable. And we know that domestic violence shelters in the state of Connecticut function at 122% capacity all the time. And a lot of people say, well, you know, what does that mean? What that means is that families are staying in playrooms and extra living areas so that we can accommodate the need for safety that's existing for victims of domestic violence and their children.
How has your work been affected by the state budget crunch?
That's such an interesting question. So the challenge for our service provision area, which is domestic violence, and I think for so many nonprofit providers, is we're expected to provide services at very critical times for individuals in our circumstances who really need safety, and to do that with very uncertainty around funding and the longevity of funding. So that's been a challenge for two reasons. One, we're just unclear of and functioning with less resources than we would traditionally, while there is no state budget. To be able to deliver services, even though the demand continues to be there. And then what we're also viewing is the safety net that used to be around people to be able to help around things like housing, education, childcare, that survivors often need in order to continue with their safety plan. Those are collapsing around us, as well as services for mental health and substance use. So it's sort of a conundrum of all of those supports that are collapsing in various ways at different levels, combined with the uncertainty around funding. It's definitely been a challenge.
It's a situation that will get worse the longer Connecticut continues running under the executive order and not a full state budget.
Yeah, you know, I think that for our organization, we oversee Connecticut's 18 domestic violence organizations that are out in the field doing that really important work. So we're talking about 400 advocates at any given time that are serving victims in courts, criminal court, when there's been an arrest, civil court, when someone needs a restraining order and help with that application, shelter, counseling, community-based resources, help with kids exposed to family violence. And so the challenge has been, how do we continue to do that? Because the need is there. And quite often, I think the expectation by policymakers is that it all continues, but there's no resources fully to continue to do that. The thought, I think, for a lot of providers was to get through this first quarter, which we see July to October 1st, with very limited revenue. It's going to get increasingly difficult October through December if this continues. And I think what we might need to see is shelters closing.
You do get a share of your funding from the state. How big a share is that?
So the state, it's a match that occurs between the state and the feds. And so it's generally 75% state funding. 75% federal funding with a 25% match. Thankfully, Governor Malloy did have the wisdom, and we appreciate his thought around this, to include the DSS line item around domestic violence shelter funding in his executive order. So that has not been impacted, and we have found that to be a very thoughtful and helpful choice. Where it gets a little stickier is legal advocacy, advocacy for children exposed to family violence. Those were not included, and so they're either getting just the federal portion or none at all, which some state agencies have decided. And so therefore, advocates and programs are needing to dip into lines of credit and function in a very strained approach.
Give us an idea of really the continuum of services that your coalition provides from when maybe police get that first call about a domestic violence incident.
Sure. So domestic violence, as we know, it occurs in multiple forms. So a lot of people associate domestic violence with just physical violence. They view that as that's domestic violence. And yes, that is domestic violence, but that's actually a really small portion of what it elevates to. For the most part, domestic violence is about power and control and one individual trying to be more powerful and take control over another. And so they might do that through verbal abuse, through financial abuse, trying to control the finances. It might be trying to control where someone's going, who they're talking to, isolating them from their family, and harassment and stalking. And so we often see that as much more prevalent than the actual elevation of physical abuse. And so we have advocates who are certified, who are trained, who have competency across the entire spectrum of the services we provide. So that's an expectation, which is rather lofty, that an advocate needs to know how to help someone apply for a restraining order in civil court, help someone if there's been an arrest on a family violence charge and assist them in court the next day, training for law enforcement and working very collaboratively with them out in the field when there's been an arrest on a family violence charge, helping kids. I mean, kids' exposure to family violence is hugely significant. There's around 1,200 kids a year who stay in domestic violence shelters. And that's just kids in shelters. That's not the thousands more that are in community. So the expectation is that we have competency in all of those areas, and combined collectively, what they do is they keep people safe. There's no one specific approach. It depends on the person and their circumstance.
Connecticut strengthened its laws against domestic violence again this past year. Give us an idea of what has changed.
Well, what's changed is basically the year before, which was really significant, which I like to go back to a lot, is the piece where we were able to work very effectively with policymakers and the Battered Women's Justice Project to have firearms taken away in the circumstance of a family violence charge. A family violence restraining order. That's significant because we know that access to firearms in a domestic violence relationship increases the chance of homicide by 5 times. An additional focus this past legislative year has been honestly on revenue and trying to work to ensure that the resources are there and that we're making the appropriate shifts within our system. And trying to be planful when we really don't understand what those revenue streams look like.
Were there also some provisions related to stalking, too, that changed?
Yeah, so the stalking, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that for you. So the stalking laws were enhanced to include emotional aspects of stalking, because before it was much more difficult to prove the impact of stalking, and so therefore it made it more difficult for law enforcement to arrest on a stalking charge, and so those were enhanced to make it more inclusive and honestly to follow best practice across the country.
Going back to that legislation that you were probably here a year ago talking about with the restraining orders and those subject to them having to turn in their firearms, how's that working so far?
You know, it's been working well. We actually convened last year around this time when it became law, October 1st, the various parties, whether it's judicial or law enforcement and advocates, to talk through how do we make this work in practice. It's one thing to have a law, but how do we bring ourselves all around the table and talk this through? What I will say is that we're not hearing of any issues, so that's always helpful because we would hear that. And we know that a few years ago, we were averaging 14 domestic violence homicides a year in Connecticut. That's now at 11. And so can we directly point to that law and or other pieces of work as reducing that? Not necessarily, but we know that hopefully collectively they're all making a difference.
There's been an effort recently to crack down on human trafficking. Can you talk about the link between human trafficking and domestic violence?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what we're finding is a couple of things. Many people don't know that we actually take in victims of human trafficking to domestic violence shelters. As a practice through the Office of Victim Services to offer them safety. So there are circumstances where on its face someone is a victim of human trafficking. What our advocates are also viewing is that often when someone is coming to a domestic violence program for help, as the work continues with a certified advocate to understand how to keep this person safe, it does come to the surface that human trafficking is involved. So there is an intersection because, as we know, domestic violence is power and control. And so victims of human trafficking are also controlled, and one person feeling powerful over another. So there really is an interesting intersection between the two. And so we're working more collectively within our system to train advocates around trafficking so they have that competency and understanding.
With domestic violence, it seems it can often be an issue that escalates, that might start off as something relatively benign, but that can escalate, and perhaps the person who needs to ask for help doesn't know when enough is enough and they can ask for help.
You point to a really great issue and a problem that we're trying to address right now, because a lot of times I don't think that someone who is experiencing this type of dynamic in their relationship doesn't wake up one morning and say, oh, I must be a victim of domestic violence, right? What they know is they're just trying to get through day to day. They're trying to get through that morning where, and I'll use he because we know that 95% of the circumstances, the man is the offender. It doesn't mean that 95% of men are abusive, but he might be texting incessantly. What are you doing? Who are you with? What are you wearing? Who are you meeting for lunch? That might seem sort of like flattering in a way, but honestly, it's someone who's trying to control your every move and be powerful over you. So I don't think people always view themselves as necessarily a victim of domestic violence. To them, it's just their relationship. And often for the person who is the victim, it's not that they don't love that person. They just want that behavior to stop. And so where we're trying to shift the focus is, how do we put the accountability on the part of the offender as opposed to placing the blame on the victim?
It is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. You are listening to Face Connecticut. We are talking to Karen Jarmock, the president and CEO of the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. We hear from law enforcement that domestic violence calls are among the most dangerous, not only for those involved in the dispute, but also for responding officers. Why is that?
I think they're very volatile situations, and it's not always clear, if there's firearms involved, B, there's a lot of emotion involved in these types of circumstances. And so they're really risky calls for law enforcement. And I think one of the reasons why we implemented something called the Lethality Assessment Program here in Connecticut 4 years ago was for two reasons. One, it's a national model that helps us identify how at risk the victim is for harm and or homicide at the scene of an incident. But what it also does is it's a tool that can protect law enforcement, because it also helps them to ask some very guided evidence-based questions, that those answers are going to be a real resource for them also in terms of their safety. What's also unique about that program is if someone rates at a high risk, the officer at the scene of the incident offers to put that person on the phone right there with a domestic violence advocate, and the officer initiates the call. What we have found is that in 83% of those circumstances, victims are actually accessing help. They're following up later and getting a safety plan, meeting with a counselor, knowing who to look for or who that person will be looking for them in court the next day, an advocate. So it's a highly effective model, and we're just so pleased to have every single law enforcement agency in the state participating at this point.
And in fact, later this month, you're going to have some findings on this.
Yeah, we partnered with the Connecticut Police Officers Training Council on this. And so basically, we know that this lethality assessment model is being used in counties or cities and in other states, but there's no state that's doing it with every law enforcement agency. And so that's very impactful. And given that, we thought it would be important to take a deep dive into the data and to hold some focus groups. And to do some other areas of study so that we can look at this project as a whole, understand its efficacy, and also understand what more might we be considering to do.
Before we started the program, you were also talking about dual arrests in domestic violence cases and in how in Connecticut they're much more common than they are in the nation as a whole.
Yeah, so dual arrest is when law enforcement's called to the scene of a family violence incident. There are times when law enforcement selects to arrest both parties, and sometimes that is warranted. But what we're finding is in 20% of those circumstances, law enforcement are arresting both parties here in Connecticut, whereas the national average hovers around 3-7%. So it's concerning to us because, as you can only imagine as a victim, if you finally muster up that courage to make that call to get help from law enforcement and you find yourself also arrested, that's hugely troubling. And then the longevity of that in terms of your arrest record and all sorts of things related to your job and other things are concerning also. So it really felt like it was time to understand, why is this happening? It's not at all pointing one finger toward another person or another entity. It's how do we work collectively to understand this problem? And then what might we be able to do again to develop some strategies around how to make it better? Is that a statutory change? We don't know. Is it a training issue? We don't know. Is it cultural within certain departments? We don't know. But hopefully by January, we will know. And there will be some recommendations in place for us to implement. And I will say it's being guided, this whole study, by representation from the parties that you would assume would have interest as well. So it's not just CCADV doing this independently. It's the judicial branch and law enforcement and public defenders and all of those parties that need to weigh in to help us to frame this out.
And this is especially important in an information age when someone's arrested, their mugshot shows up on the internet almost instantly, and it's tough to get it taken down once it's up there.
Yeah, that's a really other good indirect consequence, right? You can only imagine, again, if either you or somebody else calls law enforcement and for help, and then you're duly arrested. It's hugely, from a trauma perspective, from a police record perspective, just a bad circumstances. And I think that we can do better. And I think that, what we hear from victims is that the trauma associated with trying to reach out for help and then actually getting arrested is rather significant. And so if we can avoid that, that's very, very important. There is, which is important to know, in the current law, we have a mandatory arrest law. So what that means is law enforcement are mandated to arrest on what we call probable cause at the scene of a family violence incident. The concern is that being taken too far? There is a self-defense clause also in that law. So law enforcement can not arrest someone if it is perceived to be that they were defending themselves. But what we're finding is if a victim is defending themselves, they're also being arrested on the mandatory arrest law.
So the dual arrest report is due out in January. Will dual arrest be part of your legislative agenda for 2018, or will that be too soon?
I think it's too soon to tell because, again, we just don't know. Is this a training issue because of the self-defense clause? Is there something we need to focus on when we're training with law enforcement? Is it a statutory change? You know, some states have something called a primary aggressor law, which mandates more so that law enforcement arrests the primary aggressor as opposed to possibly a secondary individual. We just don't know yet, but I'm confident that we'll be able to find these things out because we have such a great group working on it and have some recommendations to focus on in January. And it will be in time, if it is a statutory piece, to look at in the new legislative session.
Speaking of training, what is the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence Training Institute?
Oh, that's such a great question. So it has two prongs to it. One, as I mentioned earlier, there are 400 advocates employed in various provider programs out in our communities. And so one is to train domestic violence advocates around certification, but then also those sort of trending issues that we feel are relevant. For example, how to work with kids exposed to family violence, or what are the implications of stalking and strangulation, for example. The other piece of the Training Institute is the training that we do statewide with other what we call stakeholders, whether it's law enforcement, individuals who work within state agencies like DCF and judicial and the Chief State's Attorney's Office and Public Defender's Office. And then another piece is trainings that we do for other community-based providers who are working in those safety net areas like kids, early childhood, and also mental health or substance abuse, and how we can also help to inform them around domestic violence. Given limited resources, we're taking a different approach to the Training Institute. It used to be a lot of in-person trainings, which I think is so antiquated at this point. So we're working on doing a lot of live interactive via the web or computer trainings. We're doing technical assistance guidance sheets. We're doing a chat platform so advocates can be asking questions of CCADV and themselves if they have a challenging circumstance. So we're approaching it differently in a way that is resourced differently, but also makes more sense for people to get training.
It's all about data today. How closely do you monitor incidents of domestic violence? I mean, are you scanning through news articles on a daily basis to see what is happening in Connecticut, looking for trends, looking for other information like that?
Yeah, so we do a couple of things. We collect data. So we have a data collection system called Efforts to Outcome. So it's live data. So we know at any given time, and it's protected by confidentiality, but who's being helped and what areas and how did that go or not go well so that we can learn from that. And then we also, the Domestic Violence Fatality Review Committee, which is administered by our organization, looks at domestic violence homicides and or near homicides. And so they try to understand as systemically how can we do better. And then, yeah, we have advocates and also individuals in our office who are keeping an eye on those. Mostly when we hear about it in the newspaper, those were in the violence reach a very high level. So we absolutely look at those through fatality review. But we're also trying to understand something can be listed as a domestic dispute or a breach of peace or when in fact it's a domestic violence circumstance. So I think sometimes how things are worded continue to be a challenge so that people don't really fully understand the significant scope of this problem.
If someone needs help, how do they best go about getting that?
Another great question. So they can do a couple of things. So one is there's a statewide hotline. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it's an actual certified domestic violence counselor who answers that call, which is huge. You're not going to an answering service or a triage kind of system. And it's 888-774-2900 is the statewide hotline. There's also a Spanish hotline, which is listed on our website. And then each of the individualized providers have their own separate hotlines also. If you just go to our website, which is www.ctcadv.org, that's going to list all of that information. And there's actually an interactive map where you can press on where you live. And that gives you the hotline for your area and the region and the program that serves your area. But you raise a really good point in that another piece from a resource perspective and how do we keep people safe that we are looking at right now through a task force that's been established by our board is with 18 separate hotlines within each program and a statewide Spanish and English hotline, it's confusing for people. And we know that we need to be doing a better job around how to get people help. We also know that people prefer to text today. So how do we bring ourselves into the 21st century and be more responsive in that way and offer text to chat and other ideas around how to be serving people and keep them safe?
On the other side of the coin, if someone has been the victim of domestic violence and was able to pull themselves out of that, and they want to volunteer. Are there volunteer opportunities where people can help others?
Absolutely. I would just guide people to go to our website. They can look at the map. There's a map that shows you the whole state, and you can choose, you know, depending on where you live, you can select the program and reach out directly to that localized program. So there's 18 local programs out in the field, and talk with them about their volunteer program.
And the website address is?
www.ctcadv.org.
She is Karen Jarmock, President and CEO of the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Face Connecticut. I'm Aaron Kupek. Enjoy the balance of your weekend.
Face Connecticut is a production of the News and Public Affairs Department of WTIC Radio.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours.
And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.